The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
Why does Grace run away from home?
Grace represents three different girls I worked with over the years who had been sexually abused by their own brothers at home repeatedly. And in each situation, the parents knew about it and didn't stop it. They may have done something, but it didn't stop. Grace reached a point where she was ready to kill her brothers to keep them from hurting her again. And she found herself with a hammer one night at the end of her wit. And she happened to glance up and see a travel poster and realized she would live an even worse life in jail. And that there was another way to reclaim her independence, reclaim her personhood. And running away was a viable solution.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Charlie Price about his young adult novel, Dead Girl Moon. After she leaves her family's house in California, Grace manages to hitchhike all the way from California to Spokane, Washington. And I'd like you to read the chapter that tells how she ended up in Portage, Montana.
All right. The Spokane bus station is downtown, one block off 395. The trucker is going to a warehouse farther north. He stopped, let Grace off on the corner. Spokane was cold beyond what she'd known in California. The bus station was poorly lit and full of people in shabby coats carrying cheap suitcases. Here and there a kid with a duffel, probably heading to college or back to the army. Grace sat on a wooden bench next to a woman wearing layers of clothes, a striped serape over head and shoulders. Mexican? South American? A long way from home. Time to take stock. She had two complete changes of clothes, but no warmer jacket. She'd find a heavier wrap at the Salvation Army. She had almost $300 in cash, enough for meals and at least a week in a bare-bones hotel. Well, an hour's exploration told her she was wrong. Only enough money for 3 days if she wanted to travel at the end, and she did, by bus. Wanted to disappear. Away from the I-5 corridor, so she'd go east. She'd asked around, heard, Missoula's cool, university stuff happening all the time. And Billings, biggest city, lots of business, two colleges, both good towns, large enough to have jobs, opportunities. Take Interstate 90. The day she left, she picked a newspaper off the bench while she waited. Read that a girl named Grace Herrick had been killed in a car accident coming back from a party. Good enough. From now on, she would be Grace Herrick, drop one R, so no one could bust her alias, get new ID wherever she landed. She bought a ticket to Missoula under that name. There were two buses waiting in the parking bays. Grace avoided people, didn't want to be remembered, waited to board until the driver was distracted, putting a heavy suitcase in the luggage bin. Went down the aisle to the back, covered her head, wooden surface until she felt motion. At the outskirts of Sandpoint, the driver announced the town name and the final destination, Calgary, Canada. That can't be right. She moved to the front and asked the driver about options. If you take the wrong bus? There weren't many. No bus station in Sandpoint. Even if there were, the ticket back to Spokane and on to Billings cost more than she has left. The driver told her, Highway 200 would get her to Missoula, let her out at the intersection. She'd hitch. She made it easily around the top of Lake Ponderay, but her luck ran out past the Montana border. She was stranded outside some place called Heron for hours, and then got a ragtag series of short rides in ranch pickups, each guy warning her, don't do this, too dangerous. After dark, it got pretty chilly. She found an empty barn near the highway. Next day, a woman in a GMC towing a horse trailer led her out by the hardware store in Portage, Montana. Grace was almost broke. Didn't want to risk another night in the Montana cold. Inside the hardware store, a cashier told her social services was two blocks up, one block over. Black and white sign out front. Grace had been to civic buildings before, back home in Rinn County for parking tickets and registrations. Didn't like them. Remembered they were sterile, impersonal. But she was broke now, looking for help. The lobby fit her picture, antiseptic worn gray linoleum, metal folding chairs along one wall with magazines strewn end tables on either side. A dumpy middle-aged woman wearing a headset looked up from something she was reading. Help you? I need work and a place to stay, Grace said, wishing she'd checked herself in a bathroom mirror before she started this. Knew she looked like she'd been jumping trains. The woman half stood and leaned over her counter, appraising. Runaway? She asked, pursing her lips. No. The woman sat back to her reading. Main Street across from the hardware store, Human Services. See Mackler. Dismissed. Mackler's office was more plush than Grace expected. Maroon carpet, polished wood trim and accessories, velour couches. An attractive woman at a desk in the center of the room looked Grace over, frowned, said, What? Work in a place to stay, Grace said. Hated feeling needy. Name, Grace Herrick, 1R. It got easier all the time.
There are three main teenage characters in this book, Grace, JJ, and Mick. So just tell us who JJ and Mick are and how they ended up in Portage, because none of them are from there.
My wife Jody and I traveled, and in northern Montana, we came through a town that had an absolutely beautiful main street, and yet whenever you left the main street and drove toward the river, it turned into ramshackle houses and trailers. And we thought, God, that's like a movie set. Who would wash up here? And I thought, well, a kid whose dad was a thief, because I've been working with some kids like that. A kid whose father had to move at the drop of a hat, who really had no possessions because they'd all been left behind in earlier moves. A boy who longed more than anything for an ordinary life, longed for a home for a year, longed to play a sport, longed for teammates, longed for a girlfriend, just wanted to live like he perceived other kids lived. And he was big enough and fast enough and determined enough that he felt he could make a place for himself, even if it meant leaving his father or not leaving the next time his father ran. So they were able to rent very cheaply a shack on the back of the hardware store, just like I'd seen in this small Montana town. And when I first started to write this book about 6 or 7 years ago, it was called Far Side of the Moon, and JJ was its first character, a girl who had been raised by a mother with postpartum depression that never lifted. A girl whose mother died of a quick-hitting cancer when she was young. And JJ was sent to live with Gary and Tina because Tina was the girl's aunt. JJ interested me because she was a girl without spectacular talents or gifts. She definitely had them, but they were clothed in ordinary fabric. And she wasn't traditionally attractive. She was large and mannish. Strong. So in most social situations, she was invisible and knew herself to be invisible. And as a way of coping with her life and really brightening her life, she developed a fantasy world on the far side of the moon, where she lived in a castle, a huge, beautiful castle, with flaming torches in the great room and a beautiful tapestry behind the throne. A throne that was red and large enough to sit on, to even lie down on in case someone should come to join her and start a new kingdom with her. So whenever things were leisure or wherever things were stressful, when she could, she would retreat to the castle on the far side of the moon.
Well, these three teenagers spend a lot of time together. But there's a push-pull dynamic happening between the three of them. What does Mick want from these girls, and what do these girls want from Mick?
Mick has an ulterior motive as he's come to the town of Portage. He wants to meet a friend that he can stay with when his father leaves. As soon as he gets to know Grace and Tina and sees the quality of their trailer life, that's not an option. But JJ might serve him in helping him meet other people who he might eventually befriend and stay with. JJ, much more than that, though, is a companion. Mick has a scar that he got part of the On the Lam living. He fell on a short brick wall in a trailer park, and he has this scar that goes along the side of his face, and he's a big guy with bushy hair, and he fears he looks like a monster, and she doesn't treat him as such. She doesn't avoid him. She talks to him and accepts him as he is immediately, and that's enormously soothing to him. He doesn't understand JJ. She tries to tell him about her world with the moons, and he doesn't get that. He doesn't have the psychology to understand it, and it worries him. He's not sure how tightly she's wrapped. But he really likes her as a person. In fact, when he first sees her, he thinks she's a boy, and so she's not intimidating to him in the way that a character like Grace is. Grace is perhaps not traditionally beautiful, but she's attractive, and she knows it, and she can use it. And she's slender and guarded. She's even more guarded than Mick, and Mick can project all his fantasies about having a girlfriend that he's never had onto Grace, because he won't get any real information from her. He'll never know who she is. JJ likes Mick, has liked him from the first time she saw him, liked him that he saw her. He actually saw her. She wasn't invisible to him, and he stayed with her while she talked, and he's even done things that are protective of her in a way that no one has ever defended her. And she is, to the extent that she's able in this short time, falling in love with him and wishing that there were even more to the relationship, and of course confused in the dynamics between boys and girls, what's friendship and what's love and what's sex. Grace is practically unknowable. She is going to get her needs met. She's going to get a job and make money and save that money. She is going to put up a screen that keeps her from being known at school. She will not be interested in anybody. She will join no cliques. She will refuse all dates. She will stay in absolute control of her life now. She will not give people power over her. So even though Grace and JJ live together, Grace will know a great deal about JJ and come to love her in a way. And JJ will know almost nothing about Grace, except be so delighted that she now has a companion in this horrid trailer.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Charlie Price about his young adult novel titled Dead Girl Moon. We'll be back after a short break to hear about how his experiences working with troubled teens influenced his writing career, which he began, seriously, at the age of 58. Stay tuned. Thank you. Your biography says you spent 35 years working with adolescents. Can you just give us a Cliff Notes version of what you did during those years?
Sure. I ran into a man at a lecture that I knew in New York City, and he invited me to help create a Street Academy program in Brooklyn. Street Academy was schools for high school dropouts, and they were funded by private corporations, and they channeled kids who were motivated into Harlem Prep and then into actual colleges. So street kids who had no connection at all anymore with school could go to school on the street. Our school was a converted barbecue pit. Anyway, so I began working with kids whose brothers and sisters, moms and dads were on heroin. This was in the late 60s. We had trouble hiring any what we called street counselor to be an adjunct or an ally for the kids who was not on heroin. We had students who, in dice games, the false dice would fall out of their ear where they'd hidden it, and they were shot right there at the street corner where they were playing dice. It was a very rough neighborhood, and it was filled with cars that had been stripped and burned, and people drinking and fighting were commonplace. And yet, in even that rough a neighborhood, there were all these kind of marvelous signs of life. Like every so often you'd see the hot dog vendor pushing a cart down Bedford Avenue, and you knew he was going to the playground where pro ball players were going to play the neighborhood guys. And the neighborhood had a tremendous pride in its ball players. So I learned a lot about inner city, extremely poor kids with drug-addicted and legal problem families from that. I went back to California and got a job in Head Start and began working with very young kids. As part of my job, I visited their homes. And that was another education for me because their homes were nothing like they looked on the outside usually.
How so?
They stank. They were filled with garbage. They were in incredible disarray, disorganized, things everywhere, loud, with TVs and radios blaring simultaneously. Many of the homes were awfully difficult places to be. And I had not ever seen that side of life. I mean, my family was middle class, and I hadn't imagined that families whose kids I knew as what I considered normal kids, suddenly behind the scenes, it wasn't the wizard, it was a horror show. After doing Head Start, I joined some friends and had an elementary school, our own elementary school, and then my own elementary school up in Sonoma. And then I went to Oakland and joined a school for kids who couldn't make it in the regular schools for one reason or another, socially or behaviorally. And they were an incredible mix of kids. And their parents, every one of their parents wanted the kids to succeed, and that's why they sent them to our school. And we had to adapt all our classes and yet maintain a high academic standard. And that was its own challenge. And I learned a lot about unusual kids there, not necessarily poor. Many of the families were very wealthy, but the kids that they sent to the school had some bizarre ideas and some very strange hobbies, and by and large were not able on their own to develop friendships. They needed facilitation to make social connection. So several years, I'm going to say 10 years at least into this teaching career, I wanted more. I wanted a better understanding psychologically of the kids I was starting to deal with. And I went back to graduate school. I got a master's degree in an allied therapy with a recreation focus because I believe that in recreation you talk a lot about how you spend your time in a way that's meaningful. And I thought that was a key to looking at the quality of our lives. It wasn't moralizing. It wasn't theological. It was a way that real people could say, well, is this really what I want to be doing? Is this the way I want to spend my evening? My emphasis was psychology, but I wound up learning a lot about depression and psychosis and physical disability. And I was fascinated by all that. They were worlds I hadn't known. As a teacher, I knew the worlds of math and English and science well enough to communicate them. But these were areas I'd never seen. They were like unexplored planets. And then I went to Langley Porter to work with extremely difficult adolescents who had been transferred from other treatment facilities to Langley Porter for help. From there, I went to a private psychiatric hospital and worked with adolescents and adults and alcohol drug clients in Oakland. Wound up as a therapist on the locked unit, directing the activity program in Shasta County in California.
And what prompted you to start writing fiction and putting all of these troubled teens that you had seen in your working life into your books?
Well, I appreciate that question. I thought writing fiction was like being a senator or a movie star. I thought it was impossible. I thought it was an impossible dream, but one I'd held for a long time. And I got into an argument with the owner of the school where I was academic dean at the time, and he fired me on the spot, which allowed me to get the poor man's Guggenheim. I got unemployment for a few months. And I had a long talk with my wife about whether or not I should seek gainful employment or become a ne'er-do-well writer wannabe. And we decided that at 50-something years old, this would be at least a chance to try writing. My fictional work had been published locally a little bit, and I had some skill, I felt. And I had these stories. I'd met these kids that often on the street, we'd go to the other side of the street if we see them coming. But in meeting them and working with them and knowing their story, they possessed courage that I didn't. They possessed resourcefulness that I didn't. They were determined and gutsy and creative. But they were just dealing with a different set of, a more complex set of issues than perhaps I'd ever had to deal with all at once. And I always had a coach, at least, that I could go to, that I would at least get heard or understood or some affection from my parents. But these kids, when they had a problem, if they took it home, it got worse quick. It got worse in almost every way. And so they were always left to their own devices. They always had to figure it out on their own or with each other. And I wanted to tell these kids stories because they're often vilified in our print or in our newspapers or feared by the public. Their continuation schools, oh, those kids. And yet what I was finding was entirely different. I was finding many remarkable people. And of course, I was also finding kids who were so damaged that they couldn't access those qualities any longer. I wanted to tell their stories because not only because I admired them, but because I thought they deserved to be told. And most important time in my life was when I was an adolescent, and it fit with some of the themes that I'd always wanted to talk about. But I didn't intend to write YA. I mean, I didn't set about writing young adult, I set about writing novels. And it so happened that, like many of us do, I wrote an autobiographical novel to begin with that I shopped around and people were polite. But the second novel, I wrote about one of these unusual kids, a clairvoyant kid. And the person who loved it best was a young adult editor. And I thought, if this book did well, I might wind up being able to talk with kids about the issues like of domestic violence and addiction and abuse and trouble with the law and trust. But we wouldn't have to talk about their lives, which is very difficult to do with teenagers. Just because of the issue of trust. It doesn't matter. I've been a therapist and a teacher and a counselor and a coach. I've been those supportive roles. And I know it's hard for kids to talk to us about the things that they're ashamed of in themselves or in their families. But a character We can talk about Grace, what happened to Grace and what she chose to do and how we feel about that and did that work for her and what effect did that have in her life and apply that to our own in safety. We don't have to reveal things we're uncomfortable revealing. In fact, we can even talk about it in a classroom. And I thought, gee, I've wanted to do that for years. It never occurred to me that this was a vehicle to have those kinds of conversations. So not only to celebrate the valiance of many of those kids, but also to open a door for discussion that was a safe environment where they might actually engage.
The power of books. I love
Amazing.
It. I love it.
They were extremely important to my own life and remain important. I scour for books that pull me into a chair and make me read them. I made this decision to try writing when I was about 58. And it was a hard decision because not only did I feel like a complete fool, like a man who should have dyed his hair or bought a convertible, I felt embarrassed that at the cliched, here's a guy who's now he's going to live his dream. But also it was risky economically. And I felt like here I am asking my wife to work while I'm pursuing a pipe dream. And I also had good reason to fear because I had not taken literature courses after high school. And I hadn't taken creative writing. And I didn't have credentials in that area. And I didn't have, other than the author friend Chris Crutcher, who I worked with in that school in Oakland I told you about, I had no connection at all with the writing industry. And so it was a risk. And yet, at 58, finally I was successful. I'll be forever grateful and forever amazed. And the reason I wanted to mention it is because I think it's the kind of story that tells any of us, look, if he can do it and I want to do it, I can do it. If I have a dream that I haven't at least committed to for a while at some risk, then maybe, I always thought that I could perhaps live with my mistakes, but not easily live with my regrets. And I didn't want to regret not giving writing a try. And I think it's good to know that there's other things we can try at later stages in our life and sometimes be successful. But the doing of it is a success. Even if I never sold anything, I knew that I had the guts to try it, and that was an important message to me. It changed the way I felt about myself.
Charlie Price lives in Northern California. Look for more information about him, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/twq. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.